right. Well, we are going to be back in our study of the 12 disciples, and I'm finished with the introduction as of last week. So we are going to get into a discussion of Peter. I'm guessing it's going to take us 2 weeks, except I do want to mention that these notes that I gave you, I am not intending to go through all of those passages. Actually, my goal is over the next 2 weeks to go through just a handful of key texts. In fact, I have it listed here that, let me count. I think I have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So 5 passages. So I will be looking at those. I'm going to be looking at, I guess I can write these down just in case you're taking notes. The one thing that is missing on the notes, and I still am not sure why I did not put them on there years ago, the call of Peter. So we'll look at the call. We'll look at the walking on water. I don't have any other way to say it other than that. The confession, which is also followed by something else, which is where Peter confesses you are the Christ, but then immediately after, same text, same context, same setting, he says something and Jesus says, "Get behind me, Satan." So I like using that as an illustration that don't get too excited about I'm used by God in this moment, because the very next moment might be something completely different. I mean, it can change quickly. The third thing, of course, we'll need to look at the denial passage and then also the restoration. This is probably one of my favorite texts. And since we went through the Gospel of John in church recently, you'll know it. It's John 21, and it's most of the chapter. So that I'm sure we're going to be doing this next week. I might save these two for next week just because they match each other. Three times denial, three times do you love me. There's something significant going on between that combination. So if I could, I'm going to try to get through those first three today. In the notes, I don't want to neglect the notes because I did go through a lot of work to put them together. So I do want to mention some of the things that are in them. This is going to be in the notes that says, Simon Peter, what kind of person does God choose to be a leader? And then the second set of notes is going to be, Peter, how does God develop a leader? Now, the reason I did Simon Peter, I'm taking John's cue on that. John will quite often just call him Simon Peter. The other gospel writers will use Peter once his name is changed. But John is hesitant to do so. And there are times when he will, once the name is changed, he still is calling him Simon Peter. In John 21, it's going to be interesting because he does both. He'll use Simon Peter, then he'll use Peter. So something's going on with John in the way that he perceives Peter. And part of that is they work together. In fact, in one of the accounts, it shows that Peter and Andrew were employees of Zebedee. And Zebedee is the father of James and John. So there's a connection there. But anyhow, I want to look at these texts. I'll bring up some of these details of how he's functioning as we get into it. I think when I get to the walking on water passage, I'll talk about this raw material section. But let's go to the call of Peter. Now, let me tell you, we're in the Gospels, so sometimes there are multiple places where you will find the same story. Whenever you do that, if you're careful, if you're doing a Bible study and not just a devotional, you want to pay close attention to how each of the gospel writers is presenting the material. I know that they're telling the same story, but they're from different perspectives and different emphases. And most of the time, that's how we explain to people, why do we have the life of Christ in 4 different accounts? John is the obvious one. I mean, he's starting all the way back to before creation, so it's obvious he's going a different route. I always think of John as kind of backing up the dump truck of theology and dumping it all on you at the very beginning. And then as you go through, you know who he is. You know he's the Word of God. You know that he is divine. Whereas the other gospel writers, it's slowly unfolding, but for different purposes. And it seems that they also have different audiences, and they also have different backgrounds. Luke is an unusual one. I know I spent 9 years with some of you who probably weren't here that long, but 9 years on Luke, so I definitely exhausted that. But Luke is coming from a Gentile background. So his wording, his way of presenting things is a little more in that Gentile connection. So he's an outsider. Now, Matthew's also an outsider, but for a different reason. Tax collector. You know, that's a different kind of outsider. So anyway, we can look at all of the different ways that the gospel writers present it. What I'm doing in this study, I'm not interested so much in let's compare and contrast all the different passages, but more to just zero in on which passage or passages will focus on the character of Peter. So that's really what I'm looking at here. But I will go ahead and tell you that Matthew, Mark, and John, actually all four Gospels, have the call of Peter, but the most of them, other than Luke, just give you just a very basic, brief account. Jesus was walking by the Sea of Galilee. He saw Peter and Andrew, and he called them. You know, that it called Peter, actually. Andrew is already a disciple, and we know that because of John's account. So if you're interested, if you're taking notes, if you care about this, Matthew 4, 18 to 22 is the passage for Matthew. And you can look at that. I'm not going to go through that. I just told you what it was. In fact, in that passage, it not only goes through Jesus was walking by the Sea of Galilee, he calls Peter and just says, you know, you'll become fishers of men. So that part is in there. But then you move to immediately, he went down a ways, found James and John, and said the same thing. So very basic account. Mark, very similar. Mark 1, 16 to 20. So Mark 1, 16 to 20. Very close. The Matthew and Mark are very close to one another. John has to be different in some way. John is going to add a little detail that we'll pick up later. When we look at Andrew, we'll pick up John's account because John gives us the little tidbit that it was Andrew who brought Peter to Jesus. Kind of like giving Andrew the credit that Peter didn't just come to Jesus on his own. Jesus didn't just target Peter, but Andrew was already a disciple. So that's a little tidbit, a little extra thing. The passage I will be looking at is Luke 5. And this is a lengthier passage. It's Luke 5, 1 through 11. I think because if you've been in church for years, you know, New Testament gets a lot more attention than the Old most of the time. And we know a lot of these passages very well. We might not know where to find them, but we do know the events. We know the circumstances. So the Luke 5 passage is much more developed. It's probably an indication that Luke is using Peter as a source. Because Luke wouldn't have been around during any of this. I mean, he was around, but not around Jesus or the disciples. Paul's the one who brings him into the Christian circles. So it is probably Peter's perspective, most likely. Although there's so much debate. When I was in New Testament studies, I had to decide if I wanted to study the Gospels. Study Matthew, Mark, and Luke, the Synoptic Gospels, or study John, kind of hanging out here by himself, but not together. But with Matthew, Mark, and Luke, there's always debate who's the source of the information. For Matthew, clearly, he was a disciple, so he could be the source of his own information, but he also might have included accounts from people that knew about certain things. The Transfiguration, for example, he wouldn't have been there. So he's getting it from other sources. A lot of scholars say that Mark is using Peter as a resource, and I'm sure he did. I would think all the gospel writers used all sorts of people in the Christian community. Luke, being the outsider, though, has to function like a historian. I mean, he can't say, I was there, I saw this. He has to get the accounts and then piece them together to try to put the whole story together. We don't often think of the human process because we know it's God's word. He's preserved exactly what he wants. But there is never a time when the human element disappears. There's always the divine and the human. Might have some other implications for things like the incarnation and how God is using us and all of that. So anyway, the human element is still there. All right, let me go ahead and read the passage, and then you know this text. I'm sure many of you know this text quite well, but I'll point out a couple of things, and mainly looking at this encounter. I'll mention one other thing before I read it, and that is that some debate, the other three Gospels, are they indicating the same event? That's a big question that people have, because this one is so different from Jesus is walking by the sea and then sees Peter and then he calls him. This is not quite the same. There's a little bit more detail. So some debate this might have happened after that event. But it does seem like this is a call of Peter to discipleship. So I don't know. I'm not sure. You know, there are a lot of details that the gospel writers don't include. So I can't put all the pieces together. This is Luke 5. All right, let me go ahead and read it. On one occasion, while the crowd was pressing in on him to hear the word of God, he was standing by the lake of Gennesaret. Now, I want to mention to you. Sorry, I said I was going to read through it, and then I stopped, but I need to stop there. That is the Sea of Galilee, but that is the word that would have been used, strangely enough, by the Aramaic connections. That's how the Jews would have referred to it. Galilee is more of a Greco-Roman term. So it's really a connection with the Hebrew word Kinnereth, which means harp. And in the Old Testament, it was called the harp-shaped lake. Or sea, actually, but harp-shaped. If you go up on any of the mountains, I've had students ask this question. They ask all kinds of questions, but harp-shaped. How did they know it was harp-shaped? I said, if you've ever been there, there are mountains all around it, and it's small. You can get up there, and you can see that it looks like a harp. Now, don't think modern harp. Think triangle, you know, ancient harps. But that's the shape of it. So anyhow, this is coming from the Jewish background. Weirdly enough, Luke's saying it, but that he's connecting it to that. Verse 2, and he saw two boats by the lake. Also notice he calls it a lake, but anyway. But the fishermen had gone out of them and were washing their nets. Getting into one of the boats, which was Simon's, he asked him to put out a little from the land. And he sat down and taught the people from the boat. This is an unusual event for Jesus teaching. I think most of the time it seems like he's standing. I have all kinds of speculative things in my brain, like he's been teaching a long time, he's been on his feet, now he wants to sit down somewhere. But anyhow, he picks Simon's boat. Also notice that Luke is sticking with Simon at this point, because that's who he is. So he sat down in Simon's boat, and he's teaching the people from the boat. There's also an unusual thing about, sorry, I keep interrupting myself, but I'm teaching through it while I'm talking about it. There's an unusual thing that you can test if you ever go over to Israel, and that is that the Sea of Galilee is an amphitheater. It has mountains all around it, and it has water that actually conducts sound pretty well. And so if you're standing in one particular location, with all the mountains and the water behind you, you don't have to speak very loudly. Every single person can hear you. If you're wondering how he could speak to 5,000 people, if he were in the desert, that wouldn't work very well and in a windy place. But no, this is, it's an amphitheater. And so he's utilizing the amphitheater connection. And if he's on the water, it's even easier, because now the water will also, the sound waves will bounce off of those. You're surrounded. The sound's not going to go back here. It's going to go out there. It's almost like an acoustic designer designed it. I guess the best acoustic designer did design it. But anyway, he used it. When he had finished, verse 4, when he had finished speaking, he said to Simon, "Put out into the deep and let down your nets for a catch." And Simon answered, "Master, we toiled all night and took nothing. But at your word, I will let down the nets." Now, we know this passage. We know it quite well. Let me make a little comment about the word master. And sorry, this is kind of kicking into college mode a little bit, but I guess you're used to that with me anyhow. I've been doing some studies on my classical Latin and Greek again, mainly because I'm only teaching Greek this year. This is a weird year. Normally I teach Hebrew, been doing it for a long time. Teaching Greek this year at Reformed Seminary. I taught it last year and the year before, so I'm trying to get back into what I knew at one time, you know, dig out the cobwebs. So when I'm looking at some of these variations between Luke and other gospel writers, I notice something, and there are some other commentators who validate this too. He uses the word master in the same way that the other gospel writers use rabbi. So when it says rabbi, of course, that means teacher, but that's coming from the Hebrew and the Aramaic, you know, the Jewish background. Master is the most common word that is used in Greek contexts. I even dug into Mount Olympus and Zeus, and apparently Zeus was taught by a god named Olympus. But anyway, he called him his master. So it's a term that's essentially equivalent. And in fact, in places where rabbi is used in the other Gospels, Luke uses master. So I just want to say that to say that it's not the kind of term that has the same meaning in English. For us, master sounds like, you know, something real significant. It's probably just another way of saying teacher or rabbi. It's just using the Greek form of it. Luke prefers that term whenever he has that context. So what I'm saying about that is some people will make too much out of master and they say, oh, you see, he's been a disciple for a while. He thinks, you know, that he's his master. Some take the sarcastic route and say, master, you carpenter, you think you know fishing. You know, I've heard that whole thing too. That's reading way too much into the text. What it seems to be is that he is respectful. He is telling him he is the master, he is the teacher. I mean, Jesus just taught. So all of that's true. And now he says, at your word, I'll let down the nets. Is that genuine, you know, faith, I know something's going to happen, or is it more of a, I will respect you and I will do what you ask? We know what happens, verse 6, when they had done this, they enclosed a large number of fish and their nets were breaking. So that is definitely a miracle. All night, those of you who fish, I used to with my grandfather, what's the best time to go fishing?
At night?
Or ridiculously early in the morning, which is essentially at night. But middle of the day, that a good time? No. This is definitely daytime. He has just taught a crowd. This is not in the middle of the night. This is not the normal time to fish. And yet, what happens? All the fish are as if they are jumping into the net. And it's so full that it breaks. And many, many sermons have been written and spoken about that and just how powerful that miracle is. But verse 7, they signaled to their partners in the other boat to come and help them. The partners in the other boat might be James and John, but others as well. Zebedee owned a business, so could be a bunch. And they came and filled both the boats. So this is another one. Both boats are full, so that they began to sink. Now you've got another problem. Not only are the nets full and breaking, but now there's so many fish in the boat that that would take a lot of fish. I know these are not big boats, but still, just think your normal size, like rowboat. It would take an awful lot of fish to get the thing to sink. So I can only imagine that they're probably at least ankle deep, if not knee deep, in fish. And so the whole thing is just kind of strange. Now, notice the change that takes place with Luke, but when Simon Peter saw it, you notice the little subtle change there. You know what's weird is that Luke does not record the name change. The other gospel writers do. You know, you are Simon, I'm calling you Cephas or Peter. He doesn't record that. Possibly because the other gospels are already there or the tradition is already there. He's focusing on the significance of the name change. Okay, this is really what's going on. He is Simon, but now all of a sudden that name change is coming in. And so now this is the Peter. He's not fully Peter quite yet, but this is the Peter that you're looking for, the one that you want, the leader that's going to be developed. But when Simon Peter saw it, he fell down at Jesus' knees, saying, "Depart from me, for I am a sinful man, O Lord." R.C. Sproul has a really wonderful way of beginning his book, The Holiness of God. That was a really popular book some years ago. And it started with this. And the encounter of holiness. That here Peter sees the holiness of God. It's the same exact thing that we have with Isaiah, you know, in Isaiah's call. I'm a man of unclean lips. I'm with a people of unclean lips. When we truly encounter the holiness of God, we see ourselves for who we are. And holiness is not the same as righteousness, even though that is there too, but it is the otherness, the uniqueness of God. And there is a uniqueness about Jesus here that the disciples are still trying to discern. You know, who is this man? When we get to the sea and the walking on water and all of that, and actually there's another account of the storm on the sea that's not the walking on water, but it's the same situation. I mean, this is something, you know, who is he who can command the wind and the waves? There's something unusual about him. Whether the disciples understood anything about the Trinity, I highly doubt it in the time that they were with Jesus. We have trouble enough with that doctrine, but they would not have understood that. But they knew there was something different about him. This is not just your typical prophet that we read about in all of our history. So, depart from me, I am a sinful man. I find it fascinating that Luke will put the word Peter in there, because when you think of leader, because that's really what that name Peter is, the rock, the solid rock, the one who's going to lead the disciples. You think strong personality, can commanding voice, all of that. But what is it that truly makes a leader the way that God wants his leaders? It's the one who's submissive and humble to God himself. That's the leader. We hear about it with servant leaders, but if a leader does not have humility within the context of our Christian circles, then I have every right to question whether they are the leader that God has not only selected but also is empowering, because the humility ought to be there. It ought to be flowing. It is with Jesus. You know, let this mind be in you, Philippians 2, was also in Jesus, and that is humility. So anyway, this is showing he sees himself for who he is. So important for someone who's going to be a leader. For he and all who were with him were astonished, that's probably a light term for what's really true, at the catch of fish that they had taken. And so also were James and John, sons of Zebedee, who were partners with Simon. Now we get the connection between them. We'll have more to say about them later. And Jesus said to Simon, interesting, he's still Simon. He has his moment where the Peter connection comes in. But now this is historical, so I mean it's probably before the name change. But Jesus said to Simon, do not be afraid. From now on you will be catching men. Actually, he does say that to him here. So actually all the Gospels match that. It's just that they have it in a different place. They don't have all these details. And when they had brought their boats to land, they left everything and followed him. While he was, that's actually it, verse 11. So, that's the passage I would focus on for the call of Peter, because we see his personality. We see that he is respectful of Jesus, as a teacher at least. I will say that, I have all of these other elements in here, inquisitive. He has initiative, he has involvement, but this really is showing a level of humility and respect that he has for Jesus from a very early point. So I would say that's another one. I can't make an I word out of it, but I can at least tell you humility is there. Okay, so that's the call. Let's, for the next event that I want to talk about, in the notes I'll just mention to you, it's under involvement here, Matthew 14. Let me go ahead and talk a little bit about some of these other points in the notes, though, just so I'm not ignoring the notes. You can look all of these passages up. They're usually just one phrase or sentence that Peter says, but it does show you some characteristics. One is his inquisitiveness. He is always asking questions. Now, I told you last week that I read my notes and I look at this study in a different way now than I did with my younger self. I'll call myself younger self, older self. That's me now. Younger self, I did all of this before I entered into my teaching. And so I had taught, certainly, but I mean as far as having a responsibility in an academic setting of students for a whole semester, sometimes for longer, certain things that I was not trained in, I had to learn on the fly. In fact, it's the kind of thing, if any of you have ever been teachers, you know what I'm talking about. You go through all the teaching training, and then the moment you get in a classroom, you realize there's a lot that we weren't taught, like how to handle students in certain contexts. And it's almost every year, not necessarily every semester, but almost every year, I get the inquisitive students that are annoyingly inquisitive sometimes. They'll ask questions. They'll just blurt out questions. I even had one this last semester, sat right in front, and instead of raising a hand, which is protocol, just kind of fire the question out. And then the other students are sitting around rolling their eyes, thinking, oh, no, it's him again. He's got a question. And of course, if it's a question that has absolutely nothing to do with what we're talking about, we'll talk about that later. But in most cases, if they're the kind of student that is inquisitive, but it's always on track, and sometimes even moving a little bit ahead, I entertain those. And then students will get mad at me. Why are you letting him do that? Tell him to just be quiet. It's like he's asking questions that you should be asking sometimes. And so I understand this in a different way than I did. I actually put myself more in the side of Peter when I first did this study. And I don't want to put myself on the side of Jesus as far as being his character, but I at least can say, oh, Jesus had to deal with this. He had to deal with this student who was always asking questions. And notice all the times that he's asking questions here. The meaning of things, you'll notice that's popping up. The meaning of a difficult saying, the meaning of a symbol, the fig tree. He's the one who asked the question, what does this mean? You know, he's treating Jesus as a genuine teacher, but he wants to know. He's got to know. And I've had students like that, and they can be annoying. I mean, I'll admit that the moment I see them, it's like, I have a theological question for you. And I say, of course you do, because you see me. You know, that's just how you are. And I get that. But I also have been teaching now for a little over 20 years. I've seen them develop. I've seen them go into their own ministries. Many of those who are the inquisitive types turn into leaders. They really become the leaders because of that initiative that they have. And I say initiative also, the first one to answer questions. My favorite, and I've even got it in quotes, under initiative, the third one, not knowing what he was saying, you know, said. That happens a couple of times, but, you know, just you wonder who's writing it. Actually, John doesn't include that one, but these others do. Not knowing what he said, he spoke. You know, he just speaking without thinking. And yet those are the ones that will often become leaders. Now, sometimes they don't. Sometimes if they lack humility, and that's why I pointed that out so important in the call, if they lack humility, if they turn into leaders, they're bad ones. And I've had a few of those over the years, too. When somebody's asking a question, I have to make an evaluation. I usually answer the question anyway. Is this because they just want the rest of the students to know that they know something? You know, is it just arrogance? Or is it a genuine question? And it's hard to discern that, especially when I first come into a new group. I can't always tell. Here's one that's always jumping in with a question. Is it because they want everyone else to know how much they know? Or is it genuinely because they're wanting to answer the question? Peter seems to be that second category for sure, because humility is flowing from him even at the very beginning. And he wants to be a good disciple. He wants to be a good student of Jesus. So that's there. I'll give you one other thing. This is what helps me relate to Jesus and to this whole scenario much easier. I've had the chance of going to Israel several times. And one time, I recall, we came into the Sea of Galilee region kind of late at night. It was towards dusk. And I don't know, I had this, I had been bombarded with questions on the bus all day. It was just all these students, you know, I'm like dozing off, and then all of a sudden they're poking me. You know, is that the Valley of Jezreel? Yeah, it's the Valley of Jezreel. What happened there? You're biblical studies majors, you should know. You know, that kind of thing. But I felt like I was teaching all day, and I'm the kind that when I teach, or like right now, I'll be absolutely exhausted when I'm finished, and I'll have to go off by myself. I have a colleague who's energized by this, and I don't understand that. But anyhow, that kind of interaction. So I had that interaction all day. So I thought, okay, we're getting to the Sea of Galilee. I've been there before, but I thought we were at a bed and breakfast, and I thought, well, I'm going to walk to the Sea of Galilee, and I'm going to stand there, and I'm going to pray. I'm going to have some time with the Lord. And I made the mistake of mentioning that. Well, I'm coming too. Oh, yeah, I'm coming too. It was all the guys. The women were smart enough. They were like, no, we're just going to stay here. So it was all these guys. There were six guys. And I'm a terrible judge of distance. I really am. You don't want to ask me, how far is that mountain from here? You don't want to ask me that. I'm not good, as good as some of the people who lived in this other time period. So I thought it would be like a 20-minute walk. Almost 2 hours later, we finally arrived at the shore, and all the whole way, oh, can I ask you this question? Oh, what did Jesus do here? Oh, what did he do there? And it's like, I'm not an encyclopedia. I don't remember all of the stuff, even though I studied it. We get to the shore. We all prayed. It was good. We joined hands. There were six of them, but I remember when we were walking back, I uttered my own silent prayer to the Lord. I don't know how you put up with this for 3 years. There are only six guys here. I have no idea what you did. You know, you must have had some tremendous patience. And now I understand why you went up on the mountain all the time and they couldn't find you. I get that. So, yeah, so all of that. So I'm seeing this through different eyes now than I used to. Let's look at the walking on water passage. That one is, there are two passages, but I'll mention the one, Mark 6:45-52. So Mark 6:45-52. And the one we'll look at is Matthew, which is Matthew 14, starting in verse 22. So Matthew 14, starting in verse 22. Now, there's another interesting characteristic here in this text, and that is Matthew is not the disciple or not the gospel writer who uses the word immediately all the time. If any of you in your Bible reading are going through the Gospels and you get to Mark's Gospel, everything's immediate. It's always funny. Things must have happened very quickly for Mark. I don't know, but it's everything is immediate. Matthew is not characteristically using that term. And yet in this passage, I think I counted three times that he uses it, and it's not a long passage. Now, the way that that term was used in Greek literature especially is in drama, in the telling of a story. It's kind of the attention getter. They have that in Hebrew too. It's the word behold. You'll see that once in a while in your Bibles. Behold, this happened, and you're like, what's that supposed to mean? And it's just zeroes in. This is important. This is dramatic. And in written language, it's hard to get drama or dramatic tone out of it. So this is the way to do that. The fact that Matthew doesn't use it very often, he would have been here. It would indicate to me that he thought of this as an incredibly dramatic moment. And it would have been. If we would have been there, just seeing Jesus walking on water would have been dramatic enough. But then here's old, jumping in. Here's Peter jumping into the water, and I'm going to do it too, you know, that kind of thing. that would have been a moment they would never have forgotten. I don't think the Holy Spirit had to work too hard for some of these, like helping them recall certain things. It's like, oh yeah, we know that one. We remember that one. Starting in verse 22, immediately, notice he starts with that. He made the disciples get into the boat and go before him to the other side while he dismissed the crowds. By the way, this was just after the miracle of the fish and the loaves. Okay, so huge crowd. They were fed miraculously by just a handful of fish and loaves. And now, time to get away. time to move on. And in fact, notice what he is doing. He is telling the disciples to get into the boat and go to the other side, but he doesn't do that. It says, and after he dismissed the crowds, and here's where I can say I understand him now. Big crowds, lots of stuff happening. He went up on the mountain by himself to pray. I understand that. When evening came, he was there alone. But the boat by this time was a long way from the land, beaten by the waves, for the wind was against them. And in the fourth watch of the night, that's between the hours of 3 a.m. and 6 a.m., the Romans had a system of four watches from 6 p.m. to 6 a.m., they divided them equally in 3 hours. So this is the last one. This is before daybreak. So fourth watch of the night, he came to them walking on the sea. Now that in itself is just strange, and wind and waves and all of this. And I don't know, I think I talked about it when I taught Luke, that the Sea of Galilee is, I told you about its amphitheater. It has mountains on all sides. There's one little section where there are no mountains. It's a pass through the mountains, and it's on the west side. It's actually, if you have a the harp, the shape of a, sorry, I'm drawing in the air, but this side, it's right on that point. So it's on the west side. And what happens is this, that's mountainous area, but it came off of the, any storms are coming off of the Mediterranean if they're coming from west to east. The storms can really gather on a lot of water. So big storm coming from west to east. It has coastal plains, so it's flat. And then all of a sudden when it hits the mountains, it narrows into one little pass. And think about it, if you know anything about meteorology here in Texas, if you take all that wind, all that power, and narrow it into a little pass, it's going to be powerful. It's going to speed up. And when it comes onto the water, it is coming at a speed that is much higher than what it did initially. It, in fact, it's almost as if this sea or this lake is designed for storms because there are mountains on the other side. And so all the wind can do is churn in a circle all around there. It doesn't have anywhere to go, and it's not going to come back the way it came. So when this happens, these can be severe. I've had students do this too. When we get to the Sea of Galilee, oh, that's it? You know, they have like this disappointment. Well, Lake Ray Hubbard's bigger than that. It's like, well, this, you've got to understand, they're thinking this thing has the power of a sea. It's deep, for one thing, and it also can have really horrible storms. So this is what's happening. And when the disciples saw him walking on the sea, they were terrified and said, "It is a ghost." You know, we don't know what we're looking at here. And they cried out in fear. But immediately, here's that word again, Jesus spoke to them saying, "Take heart, it is I, do not be afraid." Now, we don't have the rest of this account, but it's like, oh, it's just Jesus. I mean, there's clearly the shock still, but at least it's not a ghost or some supernatural being or something that might do something bad to them. And Peter answered him, "Lord, if it is you, command me to come to you on the water." Now, here's where, if I were a teacher, I'd be saying, oh, you would say that, wouldn't you? You would go that far. You know, you're really anxious. I know you're anxious. This gives you a little bit of a personality glimpse into Peter. People will see this as negative. And in fact, a lot of commentaries, they will say, well, this just shows how impulsive the man was. But that impulsivity, when it's channeled, when it's trained, and it's coming from someone who's humble, can be powerful, incredibly powerful. He's the one that's going to step out. He's the one that will actually do it. And notice he's doing it in this deferential, I'll use that word, but you know, humble way, telling Jesus to command him. And so Jesus says, "Come." So Peter got out of the boat and walked on the water and came to Jesus. Sounds so matter-of-fact, but that would have, the disciples by this time, their jaws are on the floor and their eyes are like ridiculously wide. But when he saw the wind, he was afraid, and beginning to sink, he cried out, "Lord, save me." Here's our word again. Jesus immediately reached out his hand and took hold of him, saying to him, "O you of little faith, why did you doubt?" And when they got into the boat, the wind ceased. And it sounds to me like it's very similar to the other event that took place earlier, actually Mark 4. You can look at that, the very end of Mark 4 is the one where they're all on the boat and Jesus is asleep. Okay, and he rebukes the wind and waves, and they immediately stop. I think there's the immediate stop here, too, because the fact that it says that they got into the boat and then the wind ceased. It's like all of a sudden. And those in the boat worshiped him, saying, "Truly, you are the Son of God." Now, that's not just Peter there. That's actually the rest of the disciples, because they have encountered something about Jesus. There's as much in this study about learning about Jesus as there is learning about the disciples, but I do want you to notice Peter's impulsiveness. I think I have it listed. I could have said impulsive, but instead I just said involvement. He's always wanting to be active in whatever's taking place. That seems to be the case. He wants to be involved. He wants to be part of what Jesus is doing. That is so important in developing a leader. And if the humility is there, that is actually going to be even that much greater later on. I wouldn't have believed that myself. I went through a lot of schooling myself, and I was in those classes where you'd always have the one, we always called them the teacher's pet, but sometimes, you know, the one that always speaks up, that always has to talk, that always will even interrupt the teacher once in a while, that kind of thing. But what you have to discern, if that person is doing it in a genuine way, they want to catch this before it disappears. They want to get this moment. They want to be there. If there's any activity taking place, they're always the first to volunteer. That is Peter's characteristic. And that is going to create a leader, because a leader is going to be the one that has to step out first. The best of leaders are not the ones that are in the back just telling people what to do. Some people think that's what leadership is. I make them do everything. I just yell at them. You know that there was a time when kings and leaders went to battle, and they led the armies. Then at some point, somebody thought, well, if they die, then we've got a problem, so let's keep them back. But when they led the armies, when they were the ones venturing forth, you've heard the Teddy Roosevelt thing, you know, not that he was a king, but just, you know, charge up the hill. That's going to be the leader. And so Peter has that potential. He has everything that he needs. It's just that he needs some training, some work. I think I'm close enough to the end. I guess we'll do the confession part. That one takes a little while for me to walk through. So I think I'll do that one next week as well, the Matthew 16. We just were in 14. This one's fascinating just because of the switch between you are the Christ to get behind me, Satan. I think that's fascinating. Then we'll look at the denial and restoration. I'll try to move a little quicker next time just to get through those. But if you have time to look at any of these passages that I've listed here, you can take a look at them. It's not exhaustive. Peter is all through the Gospels, and he speaks a lot, quite a few times, and there are many places where he's interacting. I'm just highlighting some of those. But he is a man who has initiative, he's inquisitive, and he's involved. He's always wanting to be involved. The other disciples, it seems, might not see him that way. He might be more annoying to them than just, this man is going to lead this whole community at one point. I don't know if they would have seen that in him. But God doesn't look on the outside, he looks on the inside, and he also sees characteristics that other people would call weaknesses. That gets me into that whole lesson. Their weaknesses to everyone else. But when the training comes, when everything is put together, those weaknesses become the strengths.